Yeah, and that's something that I always feel like needs to be respected, you know, like really you're right, the fabric of what's going on, you know what I mean? And that for me gets into, if I want to get back to the word jazz, I don't like the word jazz, mainly because it's too broad based.
Really?
Yeah.
And it's like when you're talking about ragtime, you're talking about a specific set of parameters. When you're talking about bebop, you're talking about a specific set, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting to say this. Let's have this discussion.
Cause yeah.
It's just something I play around with a lot, right? I can talk to people, so I think it's worth it. I just bring up three things you can talk about. I read a lot about a lot of things that Ellington felt. Ellington felt like that in about 40 years.
Yeah.
So, then later I was talking about an argument that existed in the 40s, which was this. They asked, an interesting thing happened. I can't remember which critic it was, one of the three critics. And they said, well, they'd asked Bird whether bebop was jazz, and he said no.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked Dizzy Gillespie, and he said yes.
Huh.
This was at the same time. Period. So it's striking. I'm just bringing these up because for me, these are canary in the coal mine situations. It's surprising to me that we're still rambling on about this at 70 years. If 70 years after those kind of statements, it's really, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's
that's wow. Plato and Aristotle.
What's that?
I said maybe please. Plato and Aristotle.
Yeah,
but maybe the other way around.
Yeah,
respectively. So what did Duke feel about that? How did what did he say about why jazz ended in the 40s?
Well, he thought that was a popular style that he wasn't doing anymore. That was something that they did. He knew what he in his mind. He knew what the parameters of that were. That in his mind what they were, and that wasn't what he was up to anymore.
And did he ever elaborate what those parameters were?
They would shift all the time. If you read a lot of his stuff, he's kind of incredible. I mean, actually, in terms of modern thinking, I mean, it's one of my favorites. You know, like, and I wonder why people cling on to him as a traditional thing that you should pay attention to. It cracks me up because the idea of this is we're talking about it.
He destroys the whole argument. Yeah.
And, by the end of it, you're reading. I mean, out that rock and roll is the most raucous form of jazz. What's he interested in now? Rock drumming.
Mm-hmm.
And then you still have jazz guys going around. Ellington's a genius. Everything's been tortured. Rock music isn't music.
This music.
And you think to yourself, you know, something strikes me as completely like everyone's missing the boat here.
Oh, yeah. You listen to Far East Suite, and it's like, oh, they're done. You know, their goose is cooked, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, on the last half of Eurasian, you know, stuff starts with, like, sounds like Charlie Watts playing drums.
Yeah, right.
You know,
you got all these, and you got all these fair guys playing these tunes, like they're playing all these Duke Ellington tunes. They're like, it's got to stay here. And you're like, well, Jesus, man.
Repertoire bands. So anyway, but carry on. So let's go back to jazz. I don't really want to interrupt this. This is a good point for discussion, really, I guess.
And I think that, separating the genres into subgenres and getting the real stylistic elements of them, you know, like 50s jazz, 60s jazz even, you know, there's a lack, they haven't named those, you know. That's when jazz became this all, you know, multi-headed hydra. And,
in the 60s.
Yeah, you know, in the 50s, and see, it just became this thing. It's like, oh, it's this jazz, you know. But
it was still popular.
Yeah, it was still popular. But it's like, you know, the 50s jazz had some different elements in it that you could point to. And then you have like the Miles later quartets and then like what was happening in the 60s, and then you have the fusion, and those all have like very specific elements, you know, and that you could point to. Or you take that same philosophy and just kind of apply it to any bandstand you're on. You're like, these are kind of like the elements that are at work here, and then even getting down to the individual players, you know what I mean? Like, if I'm on a gig with you and Helen, you know, I know there's this thing where it's like, well, first of all, we're listening to what we're doing, and then it's like, Helen's coming from here, you know what I mean? And you're coming from a place, and I'm coming from this place, you know. I may have grown up as, yeah, I grew up as Jazz Kid X, you know, but that's like really paying attention to those stylistic elements, I think, is what adds flexibility to any player, you know what I mean? And adds versatility in any genre. And even if you're gonna, like, you know, like a lot of jazz groups, it's like, all right, we're gonna play this tune, and it's like, it's this tune, like, we're gonna maybe reference some of these things, you know what I mean? And if we're playing trad, I'm not gonna sound like Albert Eiler unless I was really, really pissed off, you know? Right. Or, you know, I think I would have a little bit too much of a victim mentality if I did that. I think it's better to, like, see the stylistic elements at play and work with them, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know? And, I hate to see that modern jazz in New Orleans has become a thing of the past, you know. I hate to see it, you know, because that was like such an awesome thing here. It still is. I mean, even the select things that happen. But it's like, where are you going to play modern jazz in New Orleans, you know? Spotted Cat used to be a bebop joint, you know, or like a...
Well, yeah, that's what everyone was doing. I mean, that's what among the college students, I mean, we're talking about those, like Brian Wade and those were around at that time. That's what everyone was interested in doing that. But I think at a certain point, the kids going in hadn't grown up with that as their... They didn't have the same interest, and actually the teachers at the university had changed. So I mean, you know, so it was like the guys out there were playing bebop because it was the teachers were at the college were Ellis Marsalis, Stephen. They were teaching the Stephen Esikowski. They were teaching the regular main classes for every general class.
Right.
And then a little while later, it switches to guys like Brent Rose and that are teaching. I think that's a big shift in terms of like how the musicians view themselves.
Yeah, that is a good point. But I also find that, like, I don't know if it was just like all those guys, you know, all the guys early on that set the tone for the modern jazz scene in New Orleans were just out there every day playing music, you know, And, you know, on Frenchman Street, you know, it's like you had even guys that weren't coming through universities were like, they wanted to play changes and they wanted to play, you know what I mean?
But it was alive then. I mean, I used to go out and they had just seen, like, guys, that's what they did and that's what they've been doing. It wasn't like a put on, like, we played jazz, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Kemp had his club up there and it was like Smokey played drums and he was playing saxophone and that was the gift. All the guys are around. I mean, this is the language they played in, and yeah, a lot of hardly any of it actually had to do with guys in the school.
Jazz school.
That was like a minor part of the scene. So
yeah.
That really changes things, you know. I should put it as it used to be a thing where, you know, it used to be a thing on Frenchman where when guys walked out of Smug Harbor, the people walking along the street thought, wow, those are weird exotic characters, and would kind of move a little bit to the side and move out of the way. And now the guys coming out, the musicians coming out of the club, the Smug Harbor, think the people on the street are weird exotic characters and kind of back off and run to their car. This is a major cultural shift.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's an odd, you know.
Wow.
But
that's a handful, boy.
that's a cultural shift. But what? Back to you. So you put out a record last year.
Uh huh.
So and what were your ideas?
With that record, I was greatly influenced by a book called The Rest is Noise by Alex Ross. At that time, I had read that book, and it...
The Rest is what?
The Rest is Noise.
The Rest is Noise. All The Rest is Noise, yes.
By Alex Ross, which is... He's a musicologist that wrote a basic history of 20th century classical music, or like serious music in the 20th century, and kind of just what happened to it. And this just like really, this book really contextualized a lot of things that I was wondering about. You know, I don't know how to delve into it, because it just, you know, on the basic thing, you can pick up the book and just see what's in it and say like, oh, this is, but it just traces the evolution. It draws a line all the way back to the 19th century. You know what I mean? Like a straight line, you know? And, you know, I think one of the quotes from that book is like, you know, was like a John Cage quote where it's like, we're now in a point where we're like, the river has these endless number of tributaries, you know, and I'm badly paraphrasing, but it was a quote when they started to get into like the history of like maybe the 60s and 70s to the present day, or maybe even later than that, you know. You're saying it's like it's becoming this endless system of tributaries from the central river, you know what I mean? And it's like what Alex Ross does is it takes all those tributaries and follows them all back to like a single source, you know what I mean? In terms of what happened to 20th century classical music, you know? And it's really amazing, man. It dispels a lot of confusion about, you know, I feel like, you know, the 20th century is a history of oblivion, you know. It's a history of, the name of the record is An End to Oblivion. And I feel like the 20th century is a history of oblivion. You have the largest wars that had ever, you know, you had global total calamity. You had the possibility of total global extinction, you know, for the latter half of the 17th century. You had like ideologies that were stamped out. You had, you know, people's, you have the advent of not just total nihilism, you know, total relativism, whatever it is that renders asunder like centuries and centuries of thought, you know what I mean, or like replaces them or adds on to them. It's like you can't even properly place everything, you know. It's just kind of like a giant explosion in my mind of just endless possibilities. And I think what I meant, I kind of get better and better at, you know, because the liner notes I wrote, I felt completely unsatisfied with the liner notes. But I'm getting better and better at honing it in at what it was. And it's like, I feel like that explosion of the 20th century, An End to Oblivion, I'm trying to say, like, to bring it back into focus, you know, and kind of around the lens of of one's own, maybe one's own experience, maybe one's, there's a quote from a Kabbalistic rabbi that says, I'm an insignificant grain of dust in the grand scheme of the universe. For me, the universe was created. Maybe it's a call back into like the dignity of the individual and his own experience in like the endless explosion of possibilities and tangibility, like just I think the mistake of 20th century nihilism was to put a cap on it all, you know, put a cap on you know, we've found the answer, and the answer is nothing, you know. But I find it, as one satisfying explanation for me as to why our age is so retrospective, is because because of where we're coming from. We're coming from we're coming to a full-on singularity, you know, in the point of history. I'm not familiar with that.
The End of Time is a pretty famous book about.
See, I'll have to check that out.
It was a very famous book, and he became an advisor to a lot of number of administrations.
Okay, I need to write that down. And that's another thing. I think it's like the most disturbing thing to me is this tribalism and this strength, this focus on not being a loser, being the strong, this might equals right, this, you know, whether it be intellectual, artistic, physical, you know, this like.
How do you feel like the retrospective mind frame strengthens?
Because I guess I never really finished.
Sorry, carry on. I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
No, I kind of. I want to get into that.
Okay, great.
But like.
39%.
Yeah. Wow. thanks, lithium.
Yeah.
I need to write down the name of that author, but where I kind of get it from is this book called Future Shock by Toffler is his last name. And he made a great point about how whole continental histories are colliding with each other. Like, if you have a Trojan War, that's like a small tribal conflict confined to like a 20-mile zone, you know, or less. You know, it's like this extremely small conflict that has no bearing on Japan when it happens at all. Like, it couldn't be more remotely removed, you know. But as soon as that history or that lore, the people go over there and, you know, gunboat diplomacy, like, all of a sudden that myth, you have like an incredibly expansive amount of time that collides with their time, you know what I mean? So it's like, not only are you coming into contact with people, you're coming into contact with thousands of years of history and lore and personal belief, and, you know, you're coming into contact with an enormous amount of information. Well, sometime in the, you know, in the 20th century, it's like the whole globe did that. You know, it's like every single thousands of years of history came into like one singular point. You know what I mean? It's all colliding.
What did that? Is that mass communication, to be sure?
Mass communication, I think, is the biggest one. I think radio, television, and now especially the internet, you know. Whenever you have these major communication mediums, it speeds up the process, you know. Like, the printing press did the same thing, you know.
We've been in a press, that's one of my ideas for that. But that's an idea, but it seems obvious to me that replication, I mean, starting with the printing press, obsession with replication, and then just really had faster and faster systems now. So I find this real weird, because it's not like we're not really mass communicating, we're mass replicating information, and it gets faster and faster. So it's a printing press, and then we're going to get faster and faster from the Xerox, or the point of Xerox, and now we've really, microprocessor. I mean, all of our developments now have to do with this rate of replication of information.
Yeah.
It's the result of the microprocessor. It's one single, you know,
you're right.
Set of innovations that,
Make
copies of this code, copy my record, copy of this, copy of that, you know.
Yeah.
The files are getting copied, and they're getting copied, and we develop, you know. That's funny. Anyway, carry on.
You're right. That's like kind of like the essentially what it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
it's replication and distribution, you know. I guess, you know, it makes us retrospective, because we have this, like, we have this huge amount of, we have more and more, you know, replication, definition, distribution, and like, its impact's all coming to a head, you know, it's like, boom, you know?
Yeah.
Like, another point he made in his book was that 35 million Americans change residencies a year, or back in the set, like, 1970.
Uh-huh.
And there was this, you know, disposable living, everybody moving. They had, that's like more than every single major migration of peoples in throughout human history combined, you know, in one year, you know. It's like, you know, it makes like the invasions of the Mongols, it makes the German migration seem like tiny, you know what I mean? So in that sense, we're kind of at this historical singularity, you know, and that makes us retrospective, because there's just so much to process. I think there eventually be a time where it all starts to condense, you know what I mean? Well, it starts to condense, and where we find a point where there's like mental space again for like new, quote unquote, new things, you know, but you know, it's gonna take a lot. It's going to take, you know, maybe we're getting back to the very basic thing that can't be replicated, which is an individual's consciousness, you know. That's the one thing that, so far, we can't, like, replicate, you know.
So is that the thing that's whole, that's the thing that isn't it? Subject to oblivion?
Yeah, it's subject to death, it's subject to redefinition against its own will, you know, like, I'm sure Beethoven would smirk at the innumerable commentaries, you know, on his works, you know, or on his life, you know. I'm sure maybe he wouldn't find it funny.
So you like attention.
I'm actually pretty sure he wouldn't find it funny.
I don't think he'd find it funny. But
I don't think he'd find it funny at all.
He sure liked the attention.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.